Scott could return the look, Amanda caught an edge and tumbled down hard. First, she lost a pole, and then a ski, and then the other pole, and the other ski. When she finally came to a stop, her gear was scattered across 30 feet of snow uphill from where she lay. Scott caught up to her as she stopped sliding.
Impressive. If you're gonna go, go big. That's what I always say.
Amanda was on the verge of tears, her pride hurting more than anything else.
That's not funny, she said, sniffling. I'm sorry. You're right. It's not funny. Are you okay?
What do you care?
She said, wiping the snow from her face. Scott started to laugh.
It's not funny, Scott. Cut it out.
I know. I'm sorry, Mandy.
You were really flying, though. You looked good. Right up until the point you biffed. You know, we should have tagged your gear before you decided to have a yard sale.
Stop it, Amanda managed before breaking into a fit of laughter. Oh, so that was a mistake? There wasn't supposed to be a yard sale today? Whoa, then I better gather up the merchandise before we upset any of the neighbors.
He told Amanda to sit still and joined Secret Service Agent Maxwell, who was uphill gathering her equipment. When Scott reached Maxwell, he saw that he was staring into the distance at the presidential party making their way down Death Chute.
Glad I'm not on that detail, said Maxwell, as he handed Scott one of Amanda's skis.
Scott dusted the snow out of the binding, checking for damage as he waited for the next ski.
Maxwell, the reason you're not on that detail is that when it comes to skiing, you suck.
Fuck you, Harvath, said Maxwell, as he shoved the other ski at him, confident he was out of Amanda's earshot.
No, seriously. I heard that Warren Miller was looking to shoot a little footage of you for his next ski film. It's going to be a spin-off of that movie Beastmaster, only worse. He's going to call it Biffmaster. Nothing but your wipeouts.
Fuck you.
I'm not kidding. Nothing but 3 hours of wall-to-wall Maxwell face down in the snow.
Fuck you.
There'll be some of those trademark Maxwell fully geared somersaults, some awesome face plants. I think you could be up for an Oscar, my friend.
Harvath, which part of fuck you do you not understand? I mean, I'm good to go on explaining either of the two words to you.
Scott laughed as Maxwell lost his balance, reaching over to pick up one of Amanda's ski poles. Looking off toward Death Chute, Scott, too, could see the president and his detail still making their way down. The detail was doing a good job of keeping up with him. Everybody was right on the money. As he turned to take Amanda's gear back to her, he glanced once more at Death Chute, just in time to see the president's group near the trees and two Secret Service agents wipe out. Maxwell had already recovered and gone down to Amanda. He was handing over her poles when Scott skied up.
Well, Maxwell, it looks like the heat will be off your skiing at dinner tonight.
What do you mean? He asked.
I think I just saw Ahern and Houchins bite it going into that part of the chute with the trees, but with all the snow falling, it's hard to tell.
At least I'm not the only one who bought it this afternoon,
said Amanda, as she got to her feet and dusted the remaining snow off her jacket.
I told you, said Scott, the end of the day is when most wipeouts happen. You're more tired than you think, and some people push it a little too hard.
Agent Maxwell took the skis from Scott and let Amanda lean on his shoulder for balance as she put them on.
I hope nobody hit a tree, he said.
That's a good point, responded Scott as he engaged his throat mic. Sound, this is Norseman. Do we need to send the St. Bernards and Schnapps down for Ahern and Houchins? Over.
Scott's radio hissed and crackled. There was no response. He tried again.
If either of them blew their knees, I've got a buddy here who's a great surgeon. Tell Ahern and Houchins I'll split the commission with them if they use my guy. Over.
He waited longer this time, but there was still nothing but static.
Sound, this is Norseman. We saw two agents go down. Can you give us a sit rep? Over.
Sit rep was short for situation report. The president had probably pushed his guys just a little too far and just a little too fast for the end of the day. This really was the most common time for wipeouts. Ahern and Houchins were probably all right, but as head of the advance team,
Scott felt responsible for every agent and wanted to know for sure.
Sound, this is Norseman. Let's have that sit rep, over.
Nothing. Scott decided to change frequencies to the direct channel with the Secret Service command post. The blowing snow was beginning to pick up again.
Birdhouse, this is Norseman. Come in, over.
Scott,
I'm getting cold, said Amanda as she snapped into her bindings. Quiet a sec, Mandy.
Scott pressed the earpiece further into his ear, but all he got was crackling static.
Birdhouse, repeat. This is Norseman. Come in. Over.
Scott waited.
Birdhouse, repeat. This is Norseman. Can you read me? Over.
More static. Agent Maxwell looked at Scott, who shook his head to indicate he hadn't made any contact.
What do you think? Said Maxwell.
I don't know, and I don't want to cry wolf to the rest of Goldilocks' detail just yet. I'll try my Deer Valley radio. If that doesn't work, then we harden up.
Harden up was the Secret Service term for immediately closing ranks and body shielding their assignment from any potential threat. Scott tried 3 times to raise Deer Valley Ski Patrol and then tried Deer Valley's operations station. There was no response. All of the radios were completely down. Scott let out a loud whistle, catching the attention of the rest of the detail agents, and gave the harden up command by waving his gloved index finger in a high circle the wagons motion above his head. In a matter of seconds, Amanda's protective detail had her completely surrounded. There was an incredible array of weaponry drawn, from Heckler & Koch MP5s to Sig Sauer semi-automatics, and even a modified Benelli M1 tactical shotgun. The men's eyes never stopped surveying the area, as Scott explained that he had seen 2 of the president's detail agents go down, and all radio communication was dark. There probably was a simple explanation. Ahern and Houchins could just have wiped out, and the radios had been acting up all day, with the weather the most likely culprit. But that was not how the Secret Service was trained to think. Operating procedure dictated that they take the fastest and safest route back to the command center immediately. With the loss of radio contact, Birdhouse would already have scrambled intercept teams to recover both details as quickly as possible. But they were still a long way off. It was time to move. Amanda saw her chance to break in and asked,
Scott, what's going on?
Probably nothing, Mandy. But we need to get you back down to the house as quickly as possible, said Scott. You've done an awesome job today. I'm really proud of you. Your skiing is red hot. Now, the normal way we go home would take us a bit too long. If we ski through the bowl, I can have you sipping hot chocolate by the fire with your dad in 15 minutes. What do you say?
This is about him, isn't it? Has something happened? Is he okay?
I'm sure he is. And the quicker we get back, the quicker you'll see for yourself. Do you think you can do the bowl with me? I'll be right next to you.
I don't know. I think I can handle it.
Good girl.
Scott smiled reassuringly at Amanda and gave the order to move out. The detail dropped over the icy lip into the steep bowl. The wind grew more fierce and sent sharp blasts of snow into their faces. Amanda was slow, but at least she was moving forward. It was terrifying for her, but to her credit, she was doing everything Scott had taught her, weight on the downhill ski in the turns, leaning forward into her boots, and keeping her hands out in front as if she were holding on to a tray. Even though Amanda's cautious skiing slowed them down, it looked as if they were going to make it without incident. Then, the detail heard what sounded like the crack of a rifle, followed by the low rumble of a thunderhead. Scott had been around mountains too long not to recognize that sound. Avalanche. 3. Despite his form-fitting winter assault fatigues lined with a revolutionary new weatherproof thermal composite, Hassan Youssef lay in his coffin of snow and shivered. He had been one of the toughest kids growing up in his balmy South Lebanon village and was now one of the Middle East's finest snipers. But the cold and being buried alive beneath 2 feet of snow were beginning to get to him. When the hideous repetition of his own raspy breathing was finally interrupted by 2 squelch clicks over his earpiece, The fear and cold immediately disappeared, replaced by a rush of adrenaline surging through his stiff body. Yusef tensed and released his muscles several times to relieve some of the stiffness in his joints. Cradling the high-tech glare gun in his gloved hands, he heard an almost imperceptible whine as he powered the weapon up. Two more clicks over the earpiece, and he readied himself to spring from his snowy grave. Buried completely from view in several more snowy crypts nearby, Gerhardt Meiner and five more of his lions were about to undertake the most daring mission of their lives.
"Son of a bitch," cursed Sam Harper to himself, as his ski clipped the edge of another rock. He loved skiing, but hated having to follow the president down Death Chute. He had fallen a little bit behind and was glad that several of the younger guys on the detail were able to keep up with the commander-in-chief. The biggest consolation of all was that Ahern and Houchins were behind him. At least he wouldn't be the last one to ski up when the party rested in the flat area among the trees before tackling the final vertical drop. When Harper reached the beginning of the trees, everything began to happen in what, had he survived, he would have described as a split-second flash. Three final squelch clicks came over Hassan Youssef's earpiece, signaling that the last members of the President's Secret Service detail were entering the heavily treed area. Springing from his icy hideaway, Youssef began pulsing his glare gun, as his fellow team member Klaus Dreyer did the same 20 meters away. The results were exactly as planned. Even with their UV protective ski goggles, the entire protective detail, as well as the president, was dazzled. The glare guns were Russian copies of the non-lethal weapon developed by the American Air Force's Phillips Laboratory. First brought into action in Somalia in 1995, the purpose of the high-tech laser weapon was to temporarily blind and disorient an enemy. Temporarily was all Miner's team needed. Youssef and Dreyer's cross-pulsing in the narrow alley formed by the trees created a blinding laser funnel that the president's team couldn't escape. This included the members of the Secret Service counter-sniper unit, known as JAR, or Just Another Rifle, who were posted strategically throughout the trees along this leg of the president's run. Completely blinded and disoriented, several agents lost their balance and wiped out before they even had a chance to come to a complete stop. Those agents who had already been in the process of slowing down and could stop instinctively drew their weapons, but they had one major problem. They couldn't see a thing. Not knowing where their fellow agents were, or more important, where the president was, every single agent, weapon drawn or not, had been rendered not only totally useless, but helpless as well. Youssef gave the go command over his lip mic as he shouldered the glare gun and switched off the safety of his silenced German-manufactured Heckler & Koch MP5 submachine gun. The pleasure of being able to freely kill so many agents of the great Satan was almost unbearable. He had already shot two Secret Service agents before the rest of the team had fully sprung from their hiding places. As the Lions' silenced machine gun rounds drummed into the bodies of the defenseless Secret Service agents, Miner made his way toward where the president had fallen.
"Harp! Harp!" mumbled the president, from where he lay in the snow, still blind and disoriented, but alert enough to call out for the head of his protective detail as he tried to raise himself into a seated position.
Miner dropped to his knees next to him and removed the president's gloves and jacket. As he helped him sit up, he placed a copy of the Salt Lake Tribune on his chest, pulling the president's hands in so he could feel it. Instinctively, the president grabbed hold of it. Miner shot several quick Polaroids and slipped the slowly developing pictures into his pocket. Then he took the paper away and, with a pair of trauma scissors, began to cut through the left sleeves of the president's sweater and turtleneck.
"Toboggan! Where is that toboggan?"
Miner yelled.
"Harper, what's happening?" repeated the president.
"There's been an accident, Mr. President," responded Miner, in perfectly American-accented English. "You need to lie back now and remain still while we start an IV."
"Who are you? Where's Harper? What's happened to my eyes? I can't see."
"Please, Mr. President, you need to be completely quiet and completely still. My team is attending to the others. There you go. Let's just lie back. Good. Miner knew the effects of the glare gun would be wearing off soon. From his pack, he withdrew an insulated medical pouch, unzipped it, pulled out a bag of saline solution, and began an IV on the president, who continued to call for members of his protective detail and complain about his eyes. Once the IV was in place, Miner filled a syringe with a strong sedative called Versed and piggybacked it into the IV line. The effect was almost instantaneous. The president's eyes rolled back, closed, and his body went limp. As one of Miner's men rushed past, towing an all-white ski patrol-style transport toboggan, Dreyer made his way over to Hassan Youssef. Without even turning, Youssef began speaking, knowing Dreyer was behind him.
"This is Sam Harper, head of the president's protective detail, is it not?"
Though Harper was badly injured from his fall and couldn't see who was standing above him speaking, he knew the Middle Eastern accent didn't belong to anyone on his team.
"Yeah, I'm Sam Harper, and whoever you are, you're in a lot of trouble. Give yourself up."
"Typical American arrogance, even in the face of death," said Youssef.
"Fuck you," snarled Harper, as he attempted to draw his weapon.
"Once again, typical. Is nothing original in this country?"
asked Youssef, as he squeezed off a 3-round burst into the career Secret Service agent and father of two's head. Ever since Dreyer had recruited Youssef for this assignment, he had marveled at the man's hatred for the United States. That hate, coupled with the Lebanese man's intense religious fervor, made him perfect for this job. Hassan Youssef was the only non-Swiss on the team. As he began walking away, Youssef said,
"Protecting the president. He should have been the best. A pity he won't be remembered that way. The pathetic coward never even fired the shot."
When Youssef had his back completely turned, Dreyer withdrew an empty Evian bottle from the pack he was carrying and picked up Harper's Sig Sauer P229.
"I think the Americans might beg to differ,"
were the last words Hassan Youssef heard before the .357 bullet, effectively muffled by being shot through the plastic bottle, ripped through the back of his skull, killing him instantly. Dreyer placed the Sig Sauer in Harper's dead hand. He then withdrew a Model 68 Scorpion machine pistol with a silencer and fired indiscriminately into the bodies of the dead Secret Service agents lying around him. He blew through two more 20-round magazines before placing the Scorpion on the ground next to Youssef and shouldering the dead Muslim's glare gun and H&K. The waters were now sufficiently chummed. 4.
"Sound, this is Birdhouse, do you copy? Over."
"Norseman, this is Birdhouse, do you copy? Over."
Secret Service agent Tom Hollenbeck, head of the command center for the president's ski trip, had been trying to reach both details for the last 7 minutes. Communications had been sporadic throughout most of the day. The mountainous terrain, the secluded location of the command center just outside the home the president was staying in, and the terrible on-again, off-again weather made things extremely difficult. Hollenbeck called out to his assistant, Chris Longo.
"Hey, Longo, can't we do anything at all to pump this up?"
"For Christ's sake, Tom, what do you think I've been doing for the last 5 minutes?"
All right, no need to get pissy, just fix it."
"Hollenbeck, if I knew what was wrong, I would have fixed it already."
"Hold on a second, we've got the Deer Valley radios. Have we tried those?"
"Yes, I already thought of that."
"And?"
"They've also been having trouble."
"What kind of trouble?"
"Same as us. The radios just aren't working."
"Is that normal?"
"It happens, but not often."
"Damn it.
How about the smocks, then? They transmit on a different frequency than our radios, don't they?"
The smock, or dock smock, as it was officially known, was a new piece of technology made for monitoring soldiers in battle. It was a skin-tight vest with sensors, worn under the clothes, that transmitted the wearer's vital signs via a small unit in a fanny pack. It could also indicate if the vest had been breached. Even though the technology was still experimental, two duty agents on each detail were wearing one.
"Yeah," said Longo, "the smocks are on a different frequency."
"Well, see if you can punch them up."
"See if I can punch them up?
Do you want me to work on boosting our Motorolas, or do you want me working on the smock signals?
No, you work on the radios and reaching the teams. Who's watching the smocks now?
Palmer is.
Fine.
Palmer?
Yelled Hollenbeck, as Longo went back to trying to raise the two details.
Yes, sir,
responded an attractive young female agent from a corner of the Secret Service Command Center. Can you give me a full sit rep on all four smocks?
Not really.
Why not?
They've been off and on all day.
What do you mean?
I mean, sometimes they seem to transmit, and sometimes they don't.
Why?
I don't know. Could be the weather. Could be some sort of interference. For all I know, it could be that the Nintendo in the break room is messing with them. This is still experimental technology.
Well, how were they operating yesterday?
Clear as a bell. I've even got the printouts of vitals broken down over 15-minute intervals. Do you want to see them?
No. Agent Tom Hollenbeck did not want to see them. What he wanted to see was the president, his daughter, and the rest of the detail agents skiing up to the front door joking about who had eaten the most snow today.
What's the longest amount of time you've been without a smock signal?
Agent Palmer looked down at her watch.
Up till now, the longest interval without a signal was just about 3 minutes. Now we're going on 8.
The same amount of time the radios had been out of commission.
Palmer, how would you say the weather was yesterday compared to today?
A little better, but not much.
Longo!
Yelled Hollenbeck.
What now?
Asked Longo.
Do we have any rovers with a visual?
Rovers were the teams of snowmobiles and snowcats that followed the two details as closely as possible. They were loaded with what the Secret Service referred to as CATs, or counter-assault teams. The CATs were heavily armed and armored agents whose sole job was to lend the protective details fire support.
The last rover report came in as the team split before their final run from the last lap rendezvous position, right before the radios went down. Goldilocks took the low road and Hattrick opted for the high road, replied Longo.
Which high road? Asked Hollenbeck.
Death Chute.
It would have to be that one, wouldn't it?
What's the next potential rover or jar visual contact for Hattrick?
And there's a jar unit among the trees in the middle of the Death Chute.
I know about that one. I haven't been able to raise them. What about the next rover?
There's no access for a rover team until about a half a mile down from the treed plateau on Death Chute.
Hollenbeck didn't need to confirm where the next visual was for Amanda's detail. She had taken the same route home every day. There was normally a pretty good line of sight directly from the command center, but today wasn't normal. The snow was blowing harder, reducing visibility to next to nothing, and Birdhouse had lost all radio contact with any agents more than 100 yards from the command center.
So, began Hollenbeck, we have no visual or radio contact with the details for the last 8 minutes?
That's right, boss, answered Longo.
Okay, that settles it.
Hollenbeck stood up from his chair and called for everyone's attention. He slung his lip mic back over his head and toggled the transmit switch to get the attention of the agents on patrol outside the command center. For some reason, transmissions close to the command center were not interrupted. All eyes in the room and ears outside were now trained on Hollenbeck.
Everybody listen up. We have a potential hostile situation.
5. Miner gave rapid orders to Anton Schabel when he arrived with the toboggan.
Crack the blanket and help me lean him forward to get this sweater the rest of the way off.
Schabel did as he was told. In quick succession, he pounded the pockets of hot packs lining the toboggan's body bag with the butt of his semi-automatic. Before he had finished with the hot packs, Dreyer rejoined Miner and was taking over.
Yusef? Inquired Miner, as they removed the president's sweater, careful not to disturb the IV.
He left early. Cocktails with Allah.
Everything is on schedule, said Dreyer, as they worked the president's turtleneck off.
Good. Get the bag over here and lay it next to him.
Dreyer laid the body bag out lengthwise next to the president.
Everything else off now. Pants, socks, boots, ring, watch, even the underwear.
Miner wasn't leaving anything to chance. He knew the president wore at least one homing device, and that it was cleverly hidden. The fact that he might be surgically implanted with another one was unlikely, but Miner had brought the special body bag along just in case. If the president was surgically implanted with any additional homing devices, the signal would never breach Miner's clever Kevlar-like design. The bag had been constructed so that as they zipped it shut, the IV could be hung on a special rail at the rear of the toboggan, and the tube would still be feeding through the bag into the president's arm. Dreyer and Schaible placed him in the warmed bag and loaded him into the toboggan. With the lining of hot packs, at least he wouldn't freeze. Miner's plan certainly didn't entail dressing the president in new clothes, at least not yet. When the bag was belted to the toboggan, Miner spoke into his lip mic. 2 minutes. Gerhard Miner, Klaus Dreyer, Anton Schaible, and the other team members clicked into their hybrid cross-country downhill telemark skis. The incredibly strong men quickly began powering their precious cargo into the trees. 90 seconds. Dreyer led the way, wearing special night vision-style goggles. 8 days before, he had marked some of these same trees with a special paint that upon contact with air oxidized and became invisible to the human eye. The goggles now allowed Dreyer to pick up the paint's unique chemical signature and follow the escape route he had marked through the maze of trees. Finally, the flat ground grew steeper, and they picked up more speed. Klaus knew they would be out of the woods in only a few more seconds. Miner had taught his men that the plan depended on absolutely perfect timing. If the toboggan flipped over or one of them stumbled, all would be lost. There was no margin for error. 30 seconds. The team, now out of the trees, rapidly cut a diagonal path across the dangerously steep mountain face. Gravity and the toboggan's smooth round bottom began causing it to slide downhill instead of across the face. Schaible, an experienced sled dog driver, put his weight on the up mountainside of the toboggan to help it stay on course. Snow and ice screamed from the back of the rig as it dug into the mountain and fought against the unnatural course it was being forced to take. If Schaible lost it now, both he and the president would be hurled into the valley. The toboggan continued to edge out of Schaible's control. He leaned harder into the yoke and tried to right the toboggan's course. He cursed Dreyer for not computing the grade of the mountain better, and Miner for not outfitting the toboggan with a sharp set of runners like a bobsled. Schaible was the biggest and strongest of the group, and that's why he had been chosen to pull the toboggan. It looked as if he wasn't strong enough, though. Everything they had trained for and risked was going to be lost. Schaible tried again to put all of his weight on his uphill ski. The result was disastrous. The toboggan careened wildly out of control so that it faced straight down the mountain. It began to pull Schaible backward. He cursed again, sure he was going to be killed. Schaible and the president slid rapidly down the mountain instead of across it. In a last-ditch attempt to get control of the sled, Schaible threw all of his considerable bulk onto the opposite ski. For what felt like an eternity, nothing happened. The toboggan pitched hard, as if it was going to flip over and carry Schaible with it. Then, a miracle occurred. As the toboggan was close to capsizing, its upper seam caught in the frozen snow and acted like the edge of a ski, putting it and Schaible back on course. He was downhill from the rest of the team, but he saw Dreyer change direction and make his way down toward an outcropping of rock. As long as the toboggan cooperated and stayed on this new course, Schaible would be okay. While Miner resumed the final seconds of his countdown, Dreyer saw two enormous boulders looming in front of them. The boulders, which looked impassable from this distance, marked the head of a small, incredibly steep and dangerous chute. Compared to this one, Death Chute was child's play, but for 6 of the world's top mercenaries, who had spent their entire lives challenging the world's most unforgiving mountains, it would not pose a problem. When Dreyer was within meters of the small passageway, Miner reached for something strapped to his chest. It was a small black transmitter with a strip of red electrical tape wrapped around its rubber antenna. When Miner had a hold of it, he depressed its only button. A sound, like the crack of a rifle, followed by the roar of a thunderhead, reverberated from far above them as they began their arduous descent. 6. The icy snow whipped against the Secret Service's mobile command center, and every agent inside was looking directly at their chief of operations, Tom Hollenbeck. "We have had no visual or radio contact with either protective detail going on 9 minutes. Visibility is also severely impaired. I am upgrading the current situation to Hostile 2 until further notice. I want the president's residence locked down and all duty agents that are raisable to report in. The perimeter is to be locked and lit. I want the backup tactical units on deck and ready to deploy. The rest of you know your jobs, so let's move." Hollenbeck finished issuing orders and then turned his attention to the window as he tried to peer through the sea of snow. A group of counter-assault agents waited outside for their orders, which they knew would be next to come. For some reason, the radios within 100 yards of the command center still worked, so Hollenbeck didn't need to go outside to address the waiting agents. "I want both Hattrix and Goldilocks' intercept teams to mobilize immediately. You are to assess the situation and report back in person ASAP to Birdhouse, unless radio contact can be reestablished. Until then, you are to assume that we are operating dark under a hostile scenario. Your objective is to compile a sitrep and get it to me as quickly as possible. This is not an escort service. I repeat, not an escort service. As soon as you know anything, I want you back here. Don't waste any time." "Any questions?" asked Hollenbeck sternly. "Negative. Teams 1 and 2, understood. Out," came the response from the intercept leader outside the command center. Within seconds, the 2 4-man teams of Secret Service agents clad in insulated Nomex jumpsuits and medium-weight body armor had their Polaris snowmobiles fired up and were heading to intercept their respective packages. "Can we get anything aloft in this?" asked Hollenbeck of one of his operational assistants. "From here, no. It looks as if things are supposed to be getting worse. We've got the President's Marine Corps white top at the bottom of the hill, but even as good as those pilots are, this weather's impossible, and their helicopters aren't made for it. The best we could do is scramble a Black Hawk from Hill Air Force Base." "How long would it take?" 10 minutes to get it up and 20 to 30 more to get it on site. But there isn't much they can do search-wise with the visibility cut down to less than nothing. Call Hill and have them put one on standby. I want those rotors spinning until I say otherwise." The operational assistant turned away from Hollenbeck and patched through on the comm link to Hill Air Force Base to order up the bird. "Longo," barked Hollenbeck, growing tenser by the moment, "are we green yet on those Motorolas?"
"We're still a no-go.
Situation dark on all communications." "Palmer."
"Sorry, sir. Still nothing on the smocks either."
Just when Agent Hollenbeck thought things couldn't possibly get any worse, he heard the resort's avalanche sirens begin their low, mournful wail. 7. There wasn't time for him to think, only to react. For most, reacting without thinking could be a dangerous thing, but not when you were trained to make life or death decisions in milliseconds. Based on where the sounds of the avalanche came from, Scott instinctively knew that they were right in its path. The job of a protective detail in a threat situation was to immediately cover and evacuate their protectee. Evacuation, in this case, was impossible, at least for the time being, but maybe, just maybe, Scott had a chance of covering the president's daughter. It would take every ounce of skill and strength he had in his body. He managed to yell, "Avalanche!" he hoped loudly enough for the other agents to hear, and then voiced a quiet, "Oh, shit," to himself. There wasn't time to tell the other Secret Service agents what he was planning to do. Amanda apparently didn't hear his cry of avalanche or know what the loud noise was because she kept slowly skiing down the bowl. Scott pulled up short on his downhill ski and, squatting deeply like a weightlifter getting ready to deadlift, positioned himself behind Amanda. This had one chance of working. The tidal wave of snow was already barreling down on top of them. Assuming the radios were still out of commission, Scott yelled for the other agents to follow him. With the roar of the avalanche filling his ears, he couldn't be sure if anyone had heard him.
"Don't move. Just let me take you," yelled Scott,
as he grabbed all 110 pounds of Amanda Rutledge around the waist and lifted her up off her skis. Startled, she screamed, but didn't fight him. The severe downhill angle and their combined mass sent them rocketing down the slope. With the diminished visibility, Scott couldn't be sure if he had calculated right. He had to be dead on. If they undershot what he'd seen, they would be dead. If they overshot it, they would be dead. And if the blinding snow had played a trick on his eyes, and what he thought would be there wasn't, that also could result only in their death. While Amanda was by no means heavy for a girl of her age, and Scott Harvath was in incredible shape, carrying her as they raced downhill ripped and tore at every fiber of his tightly muscled body. His entire back was on fire, and his thighs felt as if there were red-hot coils wrapped around them. Every primal instinct within him shouted for him to let her go and save himself, but he had been trained to be a master of not only his body, but his mind, which meant that fear and pain would serve him, not the other way around. Amanda must have known what was going on, at least on some level, because the minute Scott picked her up, she went as limp as a kitten lifted by the scruff of the neck. He'd known when he heard the sound of the avalanche that outrunning it would be impossible. He didn't even dare venture another look back. The slightest wasted movement could immediately put the two of them on the losing side of this equation. The freezing ice and blowing snow tore into Scott's face like shards of broken glass. He and Amanda picked up more speed as they traversed the face of the bowl. This was where the simple physics of Scott's plan was working severely against them. In an avalanche, the heavy snow chooses the fastest path available to it. Drawn by gravity, this path is always straight down, tearing apart anything in its way. Instead of going straight down, Scott and Amanda were going almost straight across the mountain. With each foot they gained in going across, the avalanche gained 50 coming down. There was absolutely no room for slip-ups. Scott had no idea if his fellow agents had heard him yell, if they had interpreted the sound of the avalanche for what it was, or how they had reacted. For now, at least, there was no way to find out. He could only hope that they had taken his lead and were following right behind. The roar had become deafening, and it reverberated throughout Scott's entire body, shaking him as he held Amanda. It seemed as if they had been traveling forever, even though it had only been for a matter of seconds.
"Where are those goddamn rocks?" he screamed to himself.
As it turned out, Scott had dangerously undershot his target. Through the blizzard of blowing snow, he could just make out the outcropping further across the face and significantly below where they were now.
"Damn it," he thought.
Knowing this was his last chance, Scott pointed his skis, himself, and Amanda straight for the bottom. They picked up speed at a terrifying rate. Scott's knees pistoned up and down like jackhammers as he absorbed not only his weight but also Amanda's. He fought with all of his might to keep control of his skis, which were furiously slapping the packed snow like a pair of loose dock planks in a hurricane. He and Amanda were going way too fast. One bump in their path and it would all be over. There was no way that any skier, even one of Scott Harvath's caliber, could keep this up. Then he saw it. The outcropping of rock was racing up to meet them as quickly as the avalanche was racing down to swallow them. Harvath put the distance at 20 yards in closing. His mind raced through the trillion calculations necessary to gauge the successful achievement of the next step in his plan. Stopping. The logical answer he received to his seemingly illogical request was simply,
3, 2, 1, now!
Scott wrapped his arms tightly around Amanda and threw all of their collective weight over his left ski. He covered her as best he could with his body, acting as a human airbag to protect her from injury, as they brutally spun and pounded out of control toward the rocks below. Over and over again they somersaulted with furious speed, each time crashing down hard on one or the other of Scott's shoulders. Between the white snow of the bowl and the blowing white of the blizzard, Harvath fought hard to keep focused on which way was up and where their target was. It was impossible. They continued to flip wildly out of control. The sound of the avalanche was so loud now, he couldn't even think. As quickly as they had been rolling,
They were immediately stopped by slamming into a sheer wall of rock. Scott cried out in pain and held on to consciousness just long enough to see a torrent of wet snow pour over them and Amanda's limp body lying motionless beside him. 8. The first thing he noticed when he regained consciousness was the eerie silence. The absence of noise was deafening. They had barely made it to the rock overhang in time. The plan had just worked. They were positioned beneath a narrow stone ledge that had formed a partial barrier to the avalanche. The claustrophobic box they were in was about 11 feet long, 3.5 feet wide, and 4 feet high. They were amazingly fortunate. Where there wasn't rock, they found themselves surrounded by snow, but there was at least some room to move around, as if they were in a small cave. Scott hoped the other Secret Service agents had been as fortunate, but he doubted they had. In the dark, Harvath began to slowly make an overall assessment of his condition. His ankles felt okay, shins were fine, knees were sore, but probably would bear weight. His thighs felt like mush and were bruised, but didn't seem like a problem as long as he was lying down. He carefully fished his mag light out of his pocket and turned it on. Next, he struggled to bring his knees up to raise himself into a sitting position, and that's when the pain started shooting through every inch of his upper body. He gave up immediately. Covering Amanda during their fall, Scott had taken most of the beating along his back and shoulders. From his waist up, everything hurt, and he couldn't tell what might be broken. At least there were no apparent open fractures, and he was only bleeding slightly from an abrasion on his forehead, so for that, he gave thanks. From where he was lying, he could see the outline of Amanda's left leg. He needed to get to her, and knew it was going to hurt like hell, but he pushed the thought from his mind. With all the strength he could summon, Scott rocked his body slowly from right to left until he got up enough momentum to roll all the way over. He was right. Rolling over did hurt like hell, but it was nothing compared to what came next. When he'd been on his back, he could look straight down past his ski boots and make out Amanda's leg as she lay on her side. Now that he was on his stomach, he couldn't see her because she was behind him. Scott summoned up another surge of strength, and banishing the pain from his mind, managed to lift himself onto his elbows. This change of position sent searing red-hot spikes of pain up his arms and into his battered shoulders. He began turning his body around upon the cold, rock-strewn snow so he could face Amanda. His legs refused to cooperate, and for a moment, he was afraid he might be paralyzed. Eventually, he felt his ski boots move. Scott's incredibly weakened legs were not of much use, so he went back to dragging himself in Amanda's direction, while the incredible pain in his arms, shoulders, and back threatened to slam him back into unconsciousness. It took the resilient Secret Service agent over 15 minutes to crawl 10 feet. Even though he didn't want to, Scott was forced to stop every couple of seconds to catch his breath. He probably had cracked one, if not several, ribs in the tumble down the mountain. Nevertheless, he was alive, and if Amanda was too, then they both had won, so far. As he drew closer, he could see Amanda's chest slowly heaving up and down in the beam of his small flashlight. Thank God, she was breathing. At least she was alive. Harvath tried feebly to call out to her, but all he could manage was a hoarse whisper. He would need to get a lot closer to communicate. He continued his pattern of crawl, rest, crawl, rest, until his face was even with the back of Amanda's head. With her face turned away toward the sheer rock wall of the overhang that had saved their lives, he couldn't tell if she was conscious. Scanning the top and back of her head, he didn't see any injuries, but that didn't mean there weren't any. Scott knew that attempting to reposition her head could worsen any spinal trauma that might already be present. He would have to carefully support her head, neck, and shoulders, and at this point, he didn't have the strength to do it.
"Amanda," he whispered in his hoarse, dry voice, "can you hear me? Mandy,
Sweetheart, it's Scott. We're alive. We made it. But I need you to talk to me. I need to know if you're okay. Come on, honey. Just a couple of words. Let me know if you can hear what I'm saying.
Amanda didn't respond, and Scott didn't have the energy to keep talking. He had resisted for as long as he could this syrupy blanket of unconsciousness that had been threatening to overtake him. It was no use. As hard as he tried, he just couldn't fight it. All he wanted now was to sleep. Peaceful sleep.
I'm so sorry, Amanda.
9.
Palmer, yelled Hollenbeck to the nearest Secret Service agent in the command center. Get on the horn to Deer Valley and find out if those avalanche sirens are legit. I want to know why they're sounding and if there has been an avalanche. I want a full, and I mean full, report.
Yes, sir,
replied Palmer, who immediately contacted the resort's emergency services department.
Longo, one question. Are we green?
Negative. We're still dark.
Tom Hollenbeck had been standing for the last 9 minutes. He couldn't think of sitting down. He needed to pace. His crew knew him well enough to steer clear. He walked over to one of the windows and watched the whipping snow outside, racking his brain for what his next move should be. The president's life, his daughter's, and the lives of no less than 30 Secret Service agents were in his hands.
Sir,
cried Palmer as she came running up to Hollenbeck with her notepad.
Deer Valley says there was an avalanche.
Shit.
Give me the W's, said Hollenbeck, which was service slang for who, what, where, when, and how many. Palmer looked down at her pad and began reading off her list of facts.
Apparently, this was a pretty big one. Several ski patrollers heard it and, knowing what it was, called it into their base as a potential. Only 2 patrols actually got a visual and confirmed it.
Why only 2?
Look at the way it's snowing outside. With weather this bad, you'd have to be practically on top of anything to see it.
All right, so several patrols heard what sounded like an avalanche and called it in as a potential, while only 2 could actually give a positive visual on it? And they also called it in?
Correct, sir.
How? I thought their radios were down.
Yes, they are.
Then how did they do it?
Apparently, they used a citizen's band radio inside one of their ski patrol huts.
A CB?
The call came through loud and clear.
Why do you suppose a CB would work, but not our gear and not Deer Valley's regular radios?
Apples and oranges.
What do you mean, apples and oranges?
The CB uses a different frequency than those used by the Secret Service or Deer Valley. The weird thing is that our gear is much more sophisticated. Everyone else should be having problems, not us.
Hollenbeck agreed and tucked that nugget away for later while he proceeded with the matter at hand.
Okay, Palmer, now for the $10,000 question. Where did the avalanche begin?
According to the ski patrol, it began at Squaw Peak.
Hollenbeck's hand shot through a stack of papers and laminated charts on his desk, pulling out the topographical map the Secret Service's TAT, or Threat Assessment Team, had prepared. It detailed all of the president's known and potential ski routes, along with rotating postings for the JAR and CAT teams. Hollenbeck had a photographic memory and knew exactly where Squaw Peak was, but hoped in his heart of hearts that he was wrong. He wasn't. Squaw Peak was the highest peak of Deer Valley, and it fed directly into the basin the president and his daughter were skiing through. In anticipation of Hollenbeck's next question, Palmer said,
The slide was on this side of the mountain and would have funneled a wall of snow, ice, and debris directly along the routes of Hattrick and Goldilocks.
For the first time in 10 minutes, Hollenbeck sat back down in his chair. 10. With almost a straight vertical drop and so much that could have gone wrong with the descent, Miner's Lions had done an exceptional job. His men deserved their sobriquet. They certainly had the hearts of lions. In assembling the best-trained force for hire in the world, Miner had revived Switzerland's illustrious mercenary tradition. It seemed only fitting that his men should carry a name that honored their predecessors. Not far from the heart of the city of Lucerne was a majestic monument carved into a sheer rock face. It depicted a lion resting on a shield, bearing the Swiss coat of arms, and paid tribute to the 786 members of the Swiss Guard who died defending King Louis and Marie Antoinette during an attack on the Tuileries in 1792. Even the American author Mark Twain had called it the most moving piece of rock in the world. Upon Miner's suggestion, his men had taken the name and had been his band of courageous and deadly lions ever since. It took the lions 10 minutes to make their descent. When they emerged from the icy crevice, the lead skiers took off their skis and began removing a series of snow-white tarps that hid 3 Skidoo snowmobiles. No words were spoken, as time was still a critical element. Dreyer helped Schaeble attach the toboggan to the back of one of the snowmobiles, and Miner unzipped the bag carrying the president to make sure his IV was still firmly in place. The rest of the crew snapped out of their bindings and placed their skis into the specially fitted tubes on the sides of their snowmobiles. There were 2 riders on each machine, one to drive, and another to lay down fire if need be, though Miner knew it wouldn't be necessary. He climbed onto the back of the snowmobile driven by Dreyer, which would pull the toboggan, and gave the signal to fire up the machines and move out. 11. Scott Harvath's eyes snapped open as a searing bolt of pain spat him back into consciousness. His entire body ached. The sensation ebbed away, and then another wave came crashing back in. He had known pain of this magnitude before, as well as soul-chilling cold, during his SEAL training. That training had taught Scott that what the mind believes, the body will achieve. He and his fellow teammates had joked that in SEAL training, they had known the most horrific torture ever conceived of by the civilized world, but every single ounce of it had been designed to prepare him for situations just like this. SEALs absolutely, positively never give up. The SEAL motto was, "The only easy day was yesterday." And even though Scott Harvath's paychecks now came from the Secret Service, he would always be a SEAL. Scott moved just a fraction and had to suppress the urge to cry out. It didn't matter. One of the benefits of the pain, if you could look at it that way, was that his head was clearing and he was regaining control. His body would have no choice but to cooperate with him. Passing out again was not an option. It couldn't be an option. Scott was acutely aware that with each 10 minutes that passed, avalanche survival rates for those buried beneath the snow dropped like a stone. Harvath painfully pulled himself into a sitting position and wiggled his way over so that he was sitting directly above Amanda Rutledge's head. He set the mag light next to him and turned his palms upward. Carefully, he slid both of his hands beneath her back, supporting her head, neck, and shoulders as he rolled her over. She made no sound and continued to breathe in slow, shallow breaths.
"Mandy, it's Scott. Can you wake up for me? Say something, honey. Come on."
Scott removed his small backpack, placed it on the ground next to him, and retrieved his flashlight. He opened Amanda's eyes, expertly shining the light into each one. Her pupils didn't constrict. That was a bad sign. He focused his thoughts on getting them to safety. There was no way to tell how deeply they were buried. In an avalanche, the heavy snow could set up like wet concrete, making it nearly impossible to dig your way out. Scott remembered his radios and gave them both another try.
"Mayday, mayday. Birdhouse, this is Norseman. We need assistance. Over." Deer Valley, do you copy? Over."
Nothing but the crackle of static came back. Scott decided to conserve his energy and his oxygen. There were more important things to think about now. Number one, he had to keep Amanda warm and try to stabilize her. Number two, he had to get them both out of this situation alive. So far, he was batting 1,000 on the staying alive part, but their fight was only 50% complete. Without any radio contact or anybody knowing where they were trapped, there was no telling how long a search party would take to find them. With the weather the way it was, efforts were going to be severely hampered. Harvath had opted against having the detail agents carry the avalanche safety transmitter receivers so popular with backcountry skiers. The avalanche transmitter receiver was about the size of a small walkie-talkie and was constantly set on transmit, broadcasting a low-frequency signal, so that if someone were ever trapped in an avalanche, like now, other people in the party could set theirs to receive and start homing in on that person's location to rescue him or her. Scott was completely against this equipment for several reasons. One, an unfriendly source could potentially lock in on these signals, and two, with JAR and CAT teams strategically interspersed along their routes, help would always be immediately available via radio contact, if not visually. All things considered, he thought the choice not to outfit agents with the avalanche transmitter receivers was still the right one. However, Scott had never anticipated that their radios would go out. As if they didn't already have enough problems, Scott looked at his watch and realized it was nearing 4:45 p.m. The sun would be setting soon, and as it went down, so would the temperature. If they didn't get themselves out and to someplace warm, they'd be popsicles by morning. 12. Harvath slid out of his jacket and placed it over Amanda to help keep her warm. She was lying on snow-covered ground, so the gesture was more symbolic than anything else. Amanda would have been better served with a jacket placed beneath her, but he'd already moved her once and didn't want to risk it again. Her pupils not constricting was a sign of abnormal brain function. Despite all of Scott's efforts to cushion Amanda, she'd probably hit her head during the fall down the mountain. Only a doctor would be able to know for sure what her prognosis was, and that made their situation all the more dire. As Scott's head continued to clear, he realized they probably had a little more air available to them than he'd originally thought. He needed to begin the dangerous process of extricating himself and Amanda from their snowy dungeon. He crawled back down toward Amanda's feet, dragging his backpack with him. Confident that he was far enough away that a minor cave-in of snow or ice wouldn't land on Amanda, Scott reached into his pack and withdrew what looked like a telescoping ski pole. The pole was known as an avalanche probe and was used by search parties to feel for avalanche victims beneath the snow. As Scott began extending the device, he breathed a sigh of gratitude that he had been safety-conscious enough to bring it along. He picked an angle that looked to be the safest and easiest to dig out from and began feeding the pole through, careful not to disturb any unstable snow. The pole fed out for what felt like a million miles. They had survived a major avalanche. Shrugging off the fatigue that leaned on him like a heavy boulder, Harvath assembled his collapsible snow shovel and prayed he wouldn't bring the icy roof crumbling down on top of them. Bending his knees and putting one foot against the rock wall behind him for leverage, Scott began the delicate process of digging out. The last thing he wanted to do was to cause a cave-in. When he felt he had tunneled a sufficient distance forward, he began scraping the snow along the ceiling in front of him. It created an ice spray that rained down on his face and hands. The process was agonizingly slow. Time and again, Scott backed out of the tunnel, pulling the recently shoveled snow toward him, and deposited it within their frigid cave. On his 11th grueling trip back into the tunnel, Scott felt the shovel break the surface. He let the crisp plates of frozen snow fall down on him as he dug an exit wide enough to crawl through. A chill wind howled as he pulled himself through, and the snow was falling harder and blowing faster than before. The sun was completely gone, and Scott couldn't make out anything below them in the terrible conditions. He sat on the rim with his heavily booted foot resting within the tunnel and took 2 seconds to catch his breath. It was biting cold, but at this moment, he didn't feel it. Now that they had a way out, Scott was faced with an even bigger problem. With Amanda unconscious and unable to help him assess her injuries, moving her might cause permanent damage. On the other hand, it was equally, if not more, dangerous to stay where they were. There was a very good chance they might freeze to death, or even worse, be reburied in a second slide. Though he was certain a massive rescue effort was now underway,
There was no way the rescuers could have known that he and Amanda had traveled so far across the face of the mountain. It would take them days before they started looking in this area. He thought about using his flashlight to signal for help, but realized it wasn't powerful enough to reach any significant distance in this weather.